And now, Canada's most beloved family drama, The Whetstones, starring Darby Rosebush and Ambrose Hunter. Episode 71, The Door.
Okay, hon. Gotta head off to work.
Okay, are you going with the front door?
Front door, yeah, you bet.
Latch the back door, then, and then when you leave, I'll take the dogs out the side door.
If that's any trouble, I could go out the back door and come back in the side door and latch the back door.
Gee, that's considerate, honey, but the dogs like the side door just fine, so if you go out the back door, latch the front door first, and when I come back in, I'll see to the back door.
I'm sorry, honey.
What is it, dear?
It just seems like I've stirred up a big fuss with the door again.
No, it's fine, honey. You use the front door, I'll go out the back, and we'll just latch the side.
If you're sure it's okay.
Tune in next week when the Whetstones close the windows.
Oh, it sure looks like it's gonna rain, hon. Can you close the downstairs windows?
The upstairs windows are the ones that get a soaking.
Canadians are so nice. Okay, maybe a little boring, but definitely nice. Can they be funny, too? On today's show, our salute to Canadian humor. And now, the guy who thinks the Whetstone should have a for mature audiences warning, Colin McEnroe.
So this is a real story. Just a couple hours ago, because we're actually recording this at 10 o'clock in the morning for complicated reasons. Anyway, so don't call in. That's the first thing I should tell you. As fascinated as you may become and as impelled as you may be to add your two cents about Canadian humor and comedy, please don't call in. Well, you can call in, but no one will answer the phone. So please don't call in because that'll upset you. But anyway, I digress. So earlier today, I'm stopping at the place where I always stop every day to get a latte. And so I'm getting my latte, and I'm waiting for them to make the latte. And I'm actually reading Canadian humor on my iPad, or at least humorous Canadian fiction on my iPad, but nobody knows that. And this guy walks up to me, who I don't quite recognize, although I think maybe I know him or something. This guy walks up to me and says, "I'd kiss you if I didn't have puke breath." And then we both smile and laugh, and he walks away, and I'm thinking, that's got to be because there's a promo on the air, you know, for the last 24 hours saying we're doing a show about Canadian humor. And it sounds like something one of the McKenzie brothers would have said. And then so I went home. I can't obviously go through the day having a total stranger say that to me and not knowing what it means. So I immediately came here and Googled that. And indeed, it is some of the deathless prose from Strange Brew, the McKenzie Brothers. So I'm just saying everybody has their own little take. That's what that guy's take on Canadian humor and comedy is. The take that we're going to have is a broader one. It's going to encompass comic or humorous fiction. But it's also, we are going to take a hard look at the Canadian invasion, which happened much more quietly than the British invasion, but the Canadian invasion, which really did kind of overwhelm American comedy, I think it's fair to say, when you really sort of add up all of the Canadian presences now in American comic life. I think they wield a bigger axe or shovel, in the case of one of Trevor Cole's characters, than does American comedy itself. Homegrown comedy. Forget about homegrown comedy. We're all Canadian now. But before I introduce the guest, I feel like I'm not in a Canadian enough mood. I feel like there's a Canadian vibe that needs to get going here. So, Wolfie, could you play that clip for me?
Hey, I'm not a lumberjack or a fur trader. And I don't live in an igloo or eat blubber or own a dog sled. And I don't know Jimmy, Sally, or Susie from Canada, although I'm certain they're really, really nice. I have a prime minister, not a president. I speak English and French, not American, and I pronounce it about, not a boot. I can proudly sew my country's flag on my backpack. I believe in peacekeeping, not policing, diversity, not assimilation, and that the beaver is a truly proud and noble animal. A toot is a hat, a Chesterfield is a coat, and it is pronounced Zed, not Z-Z. Canada is the second largest landmass, the first nation of hockey, and the best part of America. My name is Joe, and I am Canadian.
Thank you.
Okay, now I'm in a Canadian mood. So joining us now, speaking of guys named Joe, it's Joe Curtis is with us. He's a novelist, author of many books, including Gratitude, which won a national Canadian National Jewish Book Award and the U.S. National Book Award. The Canadian one's the important one for fiction. His first novel, Winter Tulips, won the Stephen Leacock Award for Humor in 1989, and that's a big part of why we're about to have this conversation, which I will now explain to you in about 2 seconds what's going on here. Trevor Cole is the author of the books Norman Bray and the Performance of His Life, Fearsome Particles, and Relevantly Practical Gene, which won the aforementioned Leacock Medal in 2011. Fred Addis is the curator of the Leacock Museum and the producer of the annual Leacock Summer Festival. And I realize half, you know, three quarters of the audience is going, ooh, what? Peacock? What is that? So we better explain this right away. So I'm going to let them, I swear I'll let them talk in a second or two. But the Twain House, they do all kinds of things, the Mark Twain House here in Hartford. And usually if it's something, you know, that they think might interest the show, they call us up or, you know, they'll email us and say. But I actually noticed this. I said, wait a minute, you're doing a whole thing on Canadian humor and you haven't contacted me? You're not contemplating doing a whole show with me? Because, in fact, these two medal winners, plus a third medal winner, Dan Needles, will be at the Mark Twain House and Museum on Thursday of this week at 7 p.m. for a free talk and reading. That's assuming that Trevor Cole recovers from his lake-related, you fell into a lake? That's like such a Canadian thing.
Lake Ontario, yes, middle of Lake Ontario.
That's such a Canadian thing to have happen to you.
I felt like it at the time.
Yeah, so anyways, he's struggling a little bit with his voice today. He'll be fine by Thursday, though. And just in a little minute, you're going to meet Andrew Clark. He's the author of Stand and Deliver, Inside Canadian Comedy. We'll talk about that Canadian invasion. But let's meet these guys first and find out a little bit about, find out about this name I keep saying, Leacock, Stephen Leacock. Fred Addis, give us the thumbnail description of Stephen Leacock. He should be a household name in the United States, but somehow he is not.
Yeah, perhaps the best-known Canadian prior to World War I, a very extensive publishing record, over 65 books and hundreds of newspaper magazine articles, much of it published in the United States. I guess, in fairness, he's often called Canada's Mark Twain, but really born in England, but grew up on a small farm in Ontario, and literally used the world as his stepping stone to of all things. He was an academic. He taught political science and economics, so perhaps that's the root of all of his humor. But 1869, died in 1944. The Leacock Medal has been awarded continuously since 1947 for the best book of Canadian humor published in that year. And so it's a tremendous legacy. But like the Mark Twain House and Museum, we do lots of things with contemporary writers, and therefore people such as the gentleman around me here this morning often cross our paths, and our lives are richer for it.
I will now exhibit my very puny Leacock chops and say, first of all, I have been obsessed for much of my adult life with Robertson Davies, and Robertson Davies was kind of obsessed with Stephen Leacock, so that's how I found out who Stephen Leacock was. And I would say, although that Mark Twain thing, it does, that parallel gets drawn a lot, and of course Leacock himself was very interested in Twain and wrote about Twain. You know, I mean, Leacock's really more, he's probably closer to the James Thurber of Canada if we were going to make these kinds of invidious inter-country comparisons, and a little bit the precursor to Garrison Keillor, too. I mean, his love of small-town life and the small, undramatic mysteries that somehow or other become very funny, you know, whether they're in Mariposa or just some unnamed comic venue. He reminds me more of those guys than he does of Twain. I don't know. React to that, though, Fred.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm a huge Thurber fan myself, and grew up near the border at about 17 minutes west of Buffalo on the Lake Erie shoreline. And, of course, Garrison Keillor was a huge part of my entertainment from NPR in the States. And I would agree with you. It's the same kind of thing. Leacock was He was poor growing up. He was one of 11 children, but very soon made his mark, whereas, as we know, Mark Twain had a lot of financial difficulties later in his career. So they came at it from different ends of the spectrum, but I agree with you. Thurber, for me, is one of my all-time favorites.
Well, that's more Canadian, right? Slow and steady wins the race. You don't go plowing your money into some crazy printing press, you know? You don't even know if it's going to work.
Typewriter. I think it was a typewriter.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
Let's just talk to these writers here a little bit. I mean, you know, for both of you, and Joe Curtis, I'm going to start with you, but for both of you, obviously, writers, for the most part, really hate being defined. I mean, I'm guessing both of you think of yourselves as novelists as opposed to humorous or comic novelists, or and as novelists as opposed to Canadian novelists. But, but Joe Curtis, with what level of comfort do you wear either one of those titles, comic / humorous novelist and Canadian novelist?
Why? That's a far more complicated question than you'd expect. I'm an immigrant to Canada myself. I was 4 years old when we landed here. I was a refugee from Hungary fleeing the Russians. So I'm really Canadian. I'm a naturalized Canadian. But I came, you know, feeling outside of everything, outside of Europe. And arriving in Canada is a wonderful thing because they reinforce this sense of outsideness that you'll feel for the rest of your life, which is why I think Canadians are funny. I do see myself as a comic novelist. I became a novelist, and so I have a comic view of the world, so much of my writing is comic, although my last novel was not a comic novel. The next one is mixed. It's just, you know, I think the world's an absurd place, and Canadians have a wonderful vantage point of the big elephant south of us, and so we're so the world is very funny to us, and you know we're generally actually quite morose.
Although you know Robertson Davies said that humorists tend to be very serious men, they just happen to express their serious thoughts, you know, with that particular set of paints. I want to just pause over that. I mean, one of the things that people, I think when people think about Canada, if they're thinking in very crude and broad ways about Canada, which is how people in the United States think about many things, they think of, you know, some fusion of the Mackenzie brothers and Dudley Do-Right or something. And one of the things that gets lost is that Canada is a nation of immigrants. Really, to a comparable extent, I think, to the United States, and that the stories and the literature of Canada is quite a mix, and a mix of immigrant literature. And I sense that you're writing in a tradition. There's that separate tradition in Canada, right? It's Mordecai Rickler and A.M. Klein. And, I mean, there's like a whole tradition that you're part of that maybe isn't that obvious to the American looking across the border.
I would say that is true. It's quite different. It's really the literature is quite different. Canadians never give you the impression they own the world when they write. You know, it's maybe they give you the impression they're borrowing the world. I don't know what it is, but there's a less of a sense of belonging, I suppose, among Canadians, and a sense of insecurity.
It's a lack of hubris.
Yes, it's a lack of hubris. That's true. And also, don't forget, Canadians didn't rip ourselves from our mother's womb, Holy Britain. The United Empire loyalists from the U.S. fled north, and we never rebelled against Mother Britain. We still have a queen, you know, and... So we evolved away from Britain. We did not tear ourselves away as you did, and we never assert ourselves to the same extent because we don't have the same the sense of certainty and whatever.
Well, Trevor Cole, let me get you into the conversation here too. Reading your fiction, reading a book like Practical Gene, I feel as though you are very acutely at times playing the Canadian horn a little bit. I mean, you know, dinner...
I would never have said that.
I mean this in the most incredibly effusively complimentary way. But, you know, if somebody's going to eat dinner, they're going to eat at Ted's Big Catch, which to me sounds acutely Canadian. I mean, are you trying to get a Canadian voice into your prose?
No.
No.
In fact, I don't think of myself as a Canadian author. I think I happen to be Canadian, but there are, you know, there are kind of a set number of tropes that people identify with Canadian fiction, and I don't apply any of them to me. Practical Gene is interesting you raise that one, because it's the only place that I've used setting really as a background as opposed to just sort of a psychological landscape.
I should have asked you the question that I asked Joe. To what degree do you wear with comfort a title, an appellation like humorous novelist, comic novelist, and Canadian novelist? It sounds like that isn't necessarily a snug fit for you.
Well, I accept that one of my talents or one of my bents is a comic approach, an ironic approach. But I do chafe against the labeling of the work that I do. I enjoy it when people enjoy my writing and laugh at it. But I'm trying for more than laughter, and so when I am labeled a comic novelist, I kind of grin and bear that. I have no problem being identified as a Canadian author. I am a Canadian author. There's no doubt about that. But it's surprising to me that you would identify Canadian themes in Practical Gene, since I don't see it. But other than the fact that it takes place in a small town.
I see it.
You do you?
Yeah, I feel like there's a very Canadian voice to the prose, too. But what do I know?
Interesting.
I'm from Hartford.
Interesting. Yeah. That's fascinating to me. I mean, the voice of Practical Jean is that of Jean herself, and even though it's written in the third person. And Jean Hormarsh, is a small town middle-aged lady. And so she has a particular sound, but you wouldn't be able to say that sound is found in any of my other books. Jean is Jean, and she has a kind of way.
I would even say that third-person narrator, whoever he is, has a Canadian sound. I wish I had the prose in front of me right now. If I try to get there on my iPad, I'm going to create a hole in the universe and we'll all be sucked into it. But there's like early on, there's a thing where it's the narrator says, well, there's no way to understand this story without understanding Jean and her ceramics. So get ready. Right. Here it comes. You know?
Right.
Like, get ready. Here comes ceramics. Like, I need to brace myself for that. And to me, there's something that strikes me as Canadian. There's sort of a dry humor about like that. Get ready. I'm about to hit you with something as startling and difficult to absorb as ceramics.
Well, Jean's ceramics are particularly involved.
True, true.
So, yeah.
Yeah. All right, I can see I'm getting nowhere. I'll just say one last thing.
I'll indulge you as much as you want.
Yeah. Well, it's so Canadian to indulge me when I'm being a jerk.
Let's talk about that for a minute, if we can.
Yeah, let's.
Joe mentioned the whole thing about living beside America is like sleeping beside an elephant. I mean, I think the foundation of a lot of our Canadian humor is rooted in good manners. I mean, there's lots of things as your neighbors that we are required to have good manners about. You know, there's a couple of examples, perhaps. We were involved in some pretty heavy fights in the last century, two world wars, and, you know, by all accounts, the Americans showed up for those fights just a little bit late. So as much as we love you, we're required to have good manners about that sort of thing. your approach to Cuba is a little different than our country's approach to Cuba. We're down there pretty well all the time, although I'm told that it's filled with Americans now as well. But, when you talk about nationalizing American industry in Cuba, I mean, a lot of that happened to a lot of the founding fathers of Canada who came north after the American Revolution because they were kicked out of your country. So that's another reason why we have to have good manners in relationship to our neighbors down the south. So as much as we love them, I think there's a little bit of a not a paranoia, but we have to be careful. And so it's easiest to try to couch that in humor. And I think that's a foundation for a lot of how what you always hear about Canadians being overly apologetic and saying sorry when sorry is not asked for or even required. And I think some of that comes from our elephant next door.
We know our place. We make no assumptions, and the Americans have a lot of money, and they're louder than us, and so we just let them have the stage, and we are happy to stand in the shadows and smile and, you know.
And make jokes.
And make jokes at them. Yeah.
That's right. And when our prime minister is rattling his saber at Putin over in Russia, we sure as hell hope he's had some kind of conversation with President Obama before he starts doing that. So it's
And, you know, we elected Mayor Rob Ford, by the way. So
I know. I was going to come to that.
We do have a sense of humor.
Yeah. I was going to get on a certain kind of ground with you guys before I even said the words Rob Ford. But then you said that. I felt that would be brashly American to bring him up too early. So let's get Andrew Clark into this conversation because, let's talk about that quivering, vibrating border that they're talking about, the ways in which maybe a certain Canadian style has to do with looking at this, not just an elephant, but a garish, trumpeting, thundering elephant to the south, and then trying to come up with some kind of verbal style that responds appropriately to that elephant. Andrew, as you're listening to them talk, I mean, what do you think? What does that trigger in you?
Well, it's interesting because I wouldn't classify Canadian literature as particularly funny. In fact, if you put Will Ferguson on this panel, you'd probably have every funny Canadian author writing today on the show. Canadian literature is generally not that funny, whereas stand-up, Canadian performance comedy, is the thing that's really, if you want to talk about stuff penetrating the American culture and psyche, it's been sketch comedians like the great SCTV or the Kids in the Hall in the 90s, Wayne and Schuster, who were on the Ed Sullivan show more than any other, you know, comedy troupe or performer, or a guy like Lorne Michaels, who, you know, creates Saturday Night Live and changes comedy not only in North America but everywhere for good. So, you know, there's a streak of humor, I think, in Canadian literature. But if you looked at everything that's published, I'd say actually most Canadian literature isn't very funny. In fact, the one thing that unites it is it's incredibly depressing and always happens by a lake.
I mean, we're going to get calls from call from Margaret Atwood at some point today about all this. But
bring it on.
I just want to pause for a moment about this. I mean, Andrew, is there? I remember when I first started watching SCTV. I remember, which for people who have no familiarity of it, spawned, gave us Rick Moranis and John Candy and Andrea Martin and Catherine O'Hara and, I mean, all these fabulous comic talents. But when I first started watching, I was thinking there's something different about this. It's different from American sketch comedy, maybe in the sense that a lot of the skits don't really exactly have punchlines. They're really funny, but they're funny at a level that I feel like I can draw a line from that to Canadian comic fiction. Do you think I'm wrong?
Well, no, but what I would say about SCTV is that generation of Canadian comedians, they still had a British influence, which has always been a kind of unique strain in Canadian comedy. And they grew up watching television, but basically they grew up watching American television. So you have to sort of think of it as these Canadians watching this great American experience, sort of feeling American, knowing all the American references, being very influenced by American television. I mean, Lorne Michaels and his brother would get up at night and turn on the TV to see if that sort of cable, you know, they would put on an Indian head on when they didn't have a signal to see if it was still there. So American television is this very powerful thing. Then when they start doing comedy in Toronto, very underground, just doing Second City, which had been started first in Chicago and then transported into, started in Chicago and transported to Toronto, they basically turn the tables back on American television. So the series is the day on the life of a very bad American local TV station. So you're satirizing the thing that's sort of sent to you. I would almost relate it to the way when the British colonized the West Indies or India, places like that, they brought cricket with them. And now most of these nations are really amazing cricket-playing nations. In a way, the American television experience was so powerful in the 50s and 60s and 70s that the Canadians then turn around and do it back at America. And that's what allows them to make Americans laugh, because the frame of reference is the same.
We have to take a little break here. It's not the end of our broadcast day yet, but it seems appropriate given everything Andrew just said, especially about the whole idea of Lorne Michaels turning on the TV set in the middle of the night, to end this segment anyway with the SCTV version of the Canadian anthem.
And now, the Canadian anthem, as selected by Bob and Doug McKenzie.
Oh, Canada. Beneath it snowing there.
Yeah, you got a real good snowmobile.
Maple leaf forever.
Now the eastern it was a day. Sitting there,
nobody riding on the maple leaf.
Canada, oh Canadian, every song.
So we're talking about Canadian humor, but never forget Bachman Turner Overdrive are also Canadian. Never forget that, all right, if you know nothing else. When they slap you awake, you should know that. Joe Curtis is here with us. His books include Winter Tulips, for which he won the Stephen Leacock Award for humor and gratitude. Trevor Cole is here with us. He won the Leacock Medal in 2011 for Practical Gene. His other books, Norman Bray and the Performance of His Life, Fearsome Particles. Fred Addis is the curator of the Leacock Museum and producer of the annual Leacock Summer Festival. Andrew Clark is the author of Stand and Deliver, Inside Canadian Comedy. And he's also the director of the Humber School of Comedy at Humber College in Toronto. So everybody's in Toronto right now except me, but they're all coming to Hartford except for Andrew and Fred. And Dan Needles will join Trevor and Joe at the Mark Twain House on Thursday evening at 7 p.m. for Canadian Humor O-Rama. Get ready.
Fred is coming.
Oh, Fred's coming?
Soon.
Oh.
Yes.
All right. Well,
but
then
none of us according to Andrew, none of us will be funny, so just be prepared.
Yeah.
That's absolutely not what I said. I said you guys are the funny ones. I said,
except for the people.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about the notion of otherness. And Joe Curtis, I want to start with you about this because I think you sort of mentioned it in some of your initial comments. And it seems to me like you might be mining two or three different loads, L-O-D-E-s, of otherness. There's something about Canada and Canadian literature, Canadian humor, that is exploring sort of a question of being other, of being different. And it sounds like also you're exploring some of your own experiences of being different within that different culture.
That is true. I've always felt other, even from myself half the time. But I'm from Hungary. We escaped from Hungary when I was a little kid, crossed a minefield by night into Austria, and and I've never actually felt Hungarian because I'm also Jewish, and Jews typically feel other, although they're much more embraced by certainly the Western world more. And Canadians, again, because of our vantage point, we are on the quiet side of the border for sure. I've thought a lot about this actually because outsiders do make good comedians. The Irish and homosexuals and blacks and Jews, and I mean it's a great source of a great deal of comedy, and as Twain said, the true source of joy is not the true source of humor is not joy but sorrow. So and that's where that comes from, that sense of not belonging, never kind of being unsettled all the time and feeling displaced all the time gives you a great vantage point on the world.
Fred Addis, if you go back as far as Leacock, do you still have that sense of otherness? Was for him, say in 1912 or whenever, was U.S. culture such a big elephant? To go back to our favorite analogy, that he would have been sort of creating an apposite kind of literature, or were we just one big landmass back then?
Well, Leacock actually attended the University of Chicago, where he got his PhD degree, and so he was, as much as he is the primary promoter of all the wonderful attributes of small town life, he didn't spend a lot of time in small town himself. He was he taught for 35 years at Montreal. He went to school at Chicago as well as at Toronto. So he was very much an urban guy, but he mined that for its sentimental value and really was able to to draw on that. And it's taken Canada probably another 25, 30 years after his death to even develop a, what I would call an urban literature. And you can find that Leacock ethic still very much ingrained in our communities. Where I come from in Orillia, my goodness, people are coming north from the greater Toronto area as they retire because they want to embrace this wonderful small-town ethos that is Orillia. And they come looking for that. And Leacock was very much in the formation and creation of that. But it was almost, in a sense, artificial.
I want to go back to reading my own reading of Roberts and Davies, and I try to think about what was the magic of this? Why was this just so bewitching to me? And Trevor Cole, one thing that struck me was I felt like I was reading about a culture where really unusual things could happen because, in fact, there was sort of a confluence of a bunch of cultures. I mean, we've already touched on this a few times, but, you know, there's a way in which the world, the Toronto that he's writing about, you know, is residually British in a lot of ways, but also not unaware of the United States, but also maybe sheltered enough from all of those things so that something really unique could be going on. I always felt like I was reading about these wildly educated, fascinating, esoteric and exotic people, you know, who were aware of all these very cool influences and ideas, a bunch of people that I really didn't know in my own life. And I came to think of Toronto, which I've to this day never visited, as this just fabulous crossroads of all these different things. So how hyper-romanticized is that?
No, I think that's pretty accurate. Toronto is, you know, it's the most multicultural city in arguably in the world. And we are all interacting, and we're all getting along pretty well. And there are influences all over the place, and you know, you see that in food and in performance, fashion. It's everywhere.
And so, Andrew Clark, I'm also wondering about that British influence in the shaping of the comedy that did kind of take over America, because. I don't even know if we've really quite said this yet, but I mean, really, when you kind of look at it, it's not just Jim Carrey. It's not just SCTV. It's people came out of SCTV like Martin Short to have their own separate careers. I mean, I'm sure you've got the list of everybody who constituted that Canadian invasion. I'm wondering if some of it was that Canada was able to develop a comic style, a humorous style. There was a little bit of fusion of British style and then that huge American influence that was flowing over the border.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you went, you can go back, say, to vaudeville, and during the First World War, the Canadian soldiers, like many in the British Army, put on concert parties, so the soldiers entertaining other soldiers, doing drag and comedy and music. And out of that experience, there came a troupe called the Dumbbells, who eventually became the first sort of Canadian hit on Broadway in 1921 after the war. And the equation that they did use was British music hall plus American vaudeville plus a kind of what I would describe as a kind of a unique Canadian fatalism. I think when you look at Canada, you know, there's a fatalism there because the geography is so powerful, it really can't be conquered. You know, in America, you had this idea of winning the West, the new frontier, conquering this land. In Canada, you can't delude yourself. The geography and the climate is too daunting. And that sort of fatalism, when you see it refracted through something like the First World War, makes for a very interesting dark satire. So that is kind of the equation. It's sort of British-American and then this strange Canadian quality, which the other panelists have been alluding to, that gives it that. And then as you trace the people who've worked, that's the people who are doing that. Lorne Michaels, for instance, is the same thing. He grows up dating and eventually marrying the daughter of Frank Schuster, who was a Wayne and Schuster. So he's getting his Canadian comedy literally at the dinner table, visiting them. He spends time in England watching the Pythons, and he adores American shows like Sid Caesar, for instance. And then so when he goes to create this sort of late-night show, it's this amalgam. So I think that's the thing running through. You can see it with the great Mike Myers. It's that template. Now, I do think that's changing because Canada's changed, and the British influence is nothing like it was even in, say, the 80s. that has changed a lot. And so Canadian comedy is going to change with that. But I think that's been a pattern over the years.
Yeah, I feel as though my introduction to that kind of Canadian comedy was, it really was, if you even think about what Saturday Night Live was the first time you saw it, it was really a different kind of comedy than what I'd seen. It really represented some new flavor. And then if you go to SCTV from that, I mean, a real completely different style and rhythm to comedy. And there, it wasn't, I don't think anyway, you know, any particular set of any particular kind of commentary on Canada itself or the United States or what that relationship is. I hear that more these days. I mean, there are Canadian comedians now like Russell Peters who are really kind of tapping into that question of what does it mean to be Canadian? What's the difference between you guys and us? What's the difference between, at a very Joe Curtis level, being, you know, being from an Indian family living in Canada and dealing with all that? Andrew Clark, it seems to me that I'm hearing a little bit more of that very kind of openly stated set of questions about nationality.
That's part of the change. Stand-up comedy is a uniquely American invention. It's like jazz, I would say, in terms of America's great contribution to, you know, the performing arts. And so in Canada, that starts a little later in the 70s, because the idea to sort of stand up and say, I object, and the individual's rights versus the collective rights, in America, that's quite sacred. If you look at the Constitution, that's, I believe it's fair to say that the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that's an individual thing. In Canada, there's more of this idea of a collective thing. And
can
peace
I, can
a
I
peace
just jump in and say,
government. So you don't really see Canadians until sort of late 60s and 70s with people like Mort Saul, David Steinberg, and now you see a lot more Canadians doing stand-up. So in a way, I think it's evidence of Canada becoming more American, quite frankly. And Canadians are both uncomfortable with and excited by the idea of being quote unquote more American. You know, and you know, Canadians are people who keep lists of all the famous Canadians in America, you know, and it's not really the other way around. But I think now with someone like Nathan Fielder, who is a Humber Comedy School graduate, who has his own show, Nathan For You, and is doing very sort of brash sort of comedy pranks that are smart, but they're not cruel. Maybe that's somewhat of a Canadian thing. But again, you know, everybody goes to either New York or Los Angeles. Not everybody, but those in comedy, that's eventually where they want to be, whether they're from Australia or Canada or what have you, because that's where you get – that's the big sandbox as opposed to the small sandbox.
Trevor Cole, I think you had something there.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I think sketch comedy comes much more naturally to Canadians than stand-up. It's a more collaborative form, and it's been going on a lot longer. There was something called Spring Thaw in the 60s that was a touring comedy show that was, you know, kind of a forerunner to Second City, and my father was a performer in that. And I think there's a reason why things like SCTV have been so successful, why Lorne Michaels has been so successful. There's a real sketch comedy foundation in Canadian performing.
Actually, as you were describing that Nathan Fielder thing, Andrew, I was remembering that on SCTV, I think they did have a sketch, a pretend show that was something called something like Canadian Gaffes and Practical Misadventures or something. And it was obviously sort of a spoof of these American sort of gaffes and bloopers and practical joke shows, except it was these very formal things where someone would slowly walk up to somebody's doorbell and ring it and kind of slowly walk away and then stand in the bushes.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, I think the other thing is Canadians like to consider themselves to be nice, well-mannered.
Right.
Yet, when you look at our favorite national sport, it's hockey. I don't think of hockey as nice.
No, it's all going to come out somewhere, though. You
it's
need
the only sport besides boxing where fighting is a part of the sport. And even when you look at the government, I mean, we have a federal government here that is doing stuff so right-wing that the Republican Party, even if it's in its wildest, most wonderful dream, couldn't imagine doing.
We don't want to know about that. We want don't burst our bubble.
Really nice,
yeah.
But not so much.
Yeah, don't burst our bubble. We can't take it. All right, we need to take a quick break here. Come back for our third and final segment here. I didn't feel as though the Canadian national anthem thing went that well last time. Do you have anything else, Wolfie, so that you could play that sort of Canadian national anthem-y?
We're good with sound.
Yep.
Dr. Shatner. Okay, Bill, let's walk it through.
Okay. Oh, Canada, our home
What are you doing?
With what?
No, with the words. It sounds... You're speaking it.
I'm singing. Is that how I sing?
Just, like, oh...
Oh, Canada.
No, can you do it, Sure, no. Can you do the, like, melody, like, oh, Canada.
Oh, Canada.
Yeah, that's no. No, it's
that
good.
Sounds,
no,
that's, no. But that sounds sad.
Why are we being so nice to these Canadians? I mean, Justin Bieber and Nickelback? Come on. What have they ever given us that really matters? Oh, you going to Tim Hortons? Yeah? Pick me up a double-double and a sour cream plain, eh? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our pretty decent intern is Allison Ehrenreich. Shoot! Shoot! How you gonna score a goal if you don't shoot? Greg Hill appeared in our intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by John Candy. For show pages, articles, and the Faith Middleton Show staff's recipes for back bacon and boiled potatoes, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the challenges faced by young black men. And now, back to Colin. Shoot!
So we're back. With us are people in various ways exploring the humorous and comic traditions of Canada. Joe Curtis is with us. He's the author of many books, including Gratitude and Winter Tulips. Trevor Cole, author of many books, including Practical Gene and Fearsome Particles. Fred Addis is the curator of the Leacock Museum and producer of the annual Leacock Summer Festival that celebrates the seminal work of Stephen Leacock, who's sort of he's the Tigris and Euphrates of Canadian comic humor. That was a pretty bad analogy.
You have to remember that, Fred.
All right. And Andrew Clark is the author of Stand and Deliver Inside Canadian Comedy. He's also the director of the Humber School of Comedy at Humber College in Toronto. I can't even remember who said this phrase last time, but I glommed onto it. Notion of dark fatalism. I feel that's sort of one of the kind of interesting comic tensions too, and I kind of wonder where it comes from. I mean, one of you was saying, well, some of it's just from the landscape. There's something kind of overpowering about the landscape and about the sense that eventually we're all going to freeze to death or something. But I think it's more than that. I wonder if it's also not a little bit the Scottish tradition. I mean, we've talked about British as though it were really one tradition, but there are a lot. My sense is there are a lot of Scots in Canada. They tend to have names like Ramsay MacDonald and things like that, and that, you know, Scots are notoriously gloomy, and a lot of their humor does kind of work off that. So somebody either agree with me or get me out of this.
They're out. You know, Scots are outsiders too. This really is a Scottish nation, a Scottish Irish nation. Mm-hmm. They're out, and that's, you know, that's who we are. It's important. I think, you know, I don't want to make this, you know, too intellectual a conversation, but
it's public, you know, radio. You can do that.
You know, because Canadians have never been very nationalistic in any real sense. I mean, I think we actually have moved. I remember coming here and trying to form my Canadian identity along with my pals who were Canadians and were trying to form their identity. I think we almost went from a pre-national nation to being a post-national nation without ever stopping at national. There's no strong sense of a center or nationhood, and so we're kind of madly off in all directions. You know, Americans, you probably have heard this, but Americans are often known as, you know, Americans are the guiding force of all people who come to America, and so America is a soup and Canada's a salad, right? I mean, we're together and we try to love each other. We don't always succeed, but we try to love each other. But we don't blend in the same way. And so many, many Canadians, especially in Toronto, are hyphenated Canadians, you know, and there's a very real sense that that's who we are.
It's interesting that commercial that you played at the very beginning, that was a hugely popular thing in Canada. And probably your listeners don't realize that that was a beer commercial. Right. It almost gave Canadians a sense that it was okay to be proud of who we were, and so people really latched onto that, and it was actually quite thrilling for me, even just listening to it again. I felt quite moved.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think the Scottish thing is definitely there. I mean, people have talked about where their ancestors are from. I mean, mine have been here for quite a while. They were United Empire loyalists and all the rest. And I think the one Scottish thing is this kind of dourness. I remember someone asking my grandfather sort of how his brother was, and he said, I don't know, I wouldn't want to pry. So it's a kind of being left alone seems to be part of the Canadian dream, which is why the idea of going to the cottage or the woods is so prevalent. Having your little piece of heaven that's yours alone, and you kind of just keep out of trouble.
So
irony comes naturally to Canadians because we know it's always going to get worse. Whenever however good it is, it's going to get worse.
The assignment for everybody for further meditation after this conversation, I'm thinking, what is it about leaves? You know, Joe Curtis says that it's a salad, not a soup. You got the maple leaf. You got Trevor's protagonist. She makes ceramic leaves. There's something going on with leaves up there. I don't quite understand what
it
is.
Leaves on our flag, too. Don't forget.
Yeah, exactly. Leaf on the flag. Yeah. You know, we have a limited amount of time left, and I think we do just have to briefly touch on Rob Ford. Everything about Canadian humor is so understated. You know, everything about Canadian humor is, you know, I love humor that makes the consumer of the humor do a little bit of the work. You know, you complete the square or the circle in your own mind, and then you laugh because you did a little of that work. It's kind of, I mean, just... Is Rob Ford kind of a problem that way? I mean, he doesn't really leave very much for anybody else to do because of what he's doing.
That's why we elected him. We needed a comedian at the head of the major city in Canada.
He's a source of fascination because he's such an anomaly in our experience that we're kind of appalled and fascinated at the same time.
He, by the way, still has
me of the Trailer Park Boys. I don't know if you guys get that down there, but. It's this idea of someone who's completely living out their id. And I think we're all jealous or envious. What would it be like to spend a day with basically zero conscience? I think everyone right, would enjoy that.
Well, that like, or the McKenzie brothers are like that, too.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You know he still has the core support of a third of the city. A third. That's a lot of people. You know, it's over a million people. So it's amazing. He's a phenomenon. He really is. It's extraordinary.
Well, and I wondered about that, too. I mean, of course, one of the most powerful ways to identify – I mean, we were talking on this station a few weeks ago about Buddy Cianci, who was the mayor of Providence, and maybe not quite at the Rob Ford level. But in a lot of ways, yes, a couple of stints in prison and some pretty outlandish behavior. But there is that – one of the things that makes it possible for Buddy Cianci to even think about running for mayor again is the sort of us-and-them mentality. Like, I may be – a clown, I may be, you know, something worse than that, but I'm yours. I'm yours, and you and I identify, and there's this whole outside world that is inherently them. And I'm wondering, is there a little of that going on with Rob Ford? If he can command a million voters' support, would it be a little bit of that us and them thing?
Yeah, when they started going after him for having too much to drink, you kind of alienate a third of Canadians right there.
Yeah.
If you're saying, hey, this guy drinks too much, there's a lot of Canadians out there who on Friday, Saturday, Thursday, they like to have a few pops.
Yeah.
So they're already thinking, well, geez, you know, you're attacking me, so you're absolutely right. But then it just kind of spiraled, and he became almost like the Uber mayor. I mean, it is always mayors who seem to get up to all this crazy stuff.
Right.
It's Mayor Quimby on The Simpsons. I mean, there's just something about being mayor that makes you either become deviant or want to be deviant or you name it. Mm. So I think that was part of it.
Well, we're out of time here, but I just want to say this has been a wonderful experience for me, and the Canadians are all pretending right now it's a wonderful experience for them. God knows what they're really thinking, and they'll say
it was terrific.
Well, yeah, see?
I'm sorry, Colin.
Yeah, when the mics are off, God knows what they'll say. But anyway, it's been so great to talk to Joe Curtis and Trevor Cole and Fred Addis, all of whom, it turns out, will join Dan Needles here at the Mark Twain House and Museum on Thursday night at 7 p.m. It's a free talk and reading. You'll hear them read from their work. You'll feel as vicariously Canadian as it is possible for you to feel here in Hartford. And that's at 7 p.m. Andrew Clark, great to talk to you. Enjoy reading your work, which runs all over the place. And, of course, author of Stand and Deliver, Inside Canadian Comedy. Thanks to everybody else who helped out with the show today, especially Wolfie, who pulled the whole thing together. We'll be back tomorrow. But for now, goodbye.
Force the Americans to have free health care. We'll bring winter to Australia. To France, we'll bring poutine. Then we'll conquer Britain and install our queen. When Canada rules the world,
Canada, Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada, Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada.
And we shall I'll tell them what to do, and if they say they won't, we shall ask again politely. And if they still don't, we will tell them it's all right. We don't mean to criticize, but perhaps they would consider some form of compromise. When Canada rules the world,
Canada, Canada,
when Canada rules the world,
Canada,
Canada rules the world.
Kyone Wolf here, just a click away from enjoying the Chinook with a plate of poutine and a beaver tail with some pea meal wrapped around it, and I'll wash it down with a twofer that I got for 10 bones up along Winterpeg. You got all that, eh?